My name is Max Klein, and I'm a master's student in the Environmental Studies program at York University, where my research focuses on indigenous food sovereignty and climate change. I have been very fortunate to work as a research assistant with our faculty member, Dr. Deborah McGregor, in the Indigenous Environmental Justice Project. As part of my work with this research project, I was able to conduct and record interviews with knowledge holders. For my major research project, I wanted to create this podcast to share with you how the discussions which emerge from considering indigenous perspectives on environmental justice illustrate the connections between food, medicine, social issues, and the problematic relationships with land that emerge from resource extraction and short-sighted greed. As a non-Indigenous researcher, I intend for this podcast to amplify and support the voices of Indigenous people in my community and illuminate holistic frameworks for the pursuit of environmental justice. In January of 2019, I had the chance to sit down with my advisor, Professor Lisa Myers, to discuss some of her knowledge about food.
I think probably since 1997, when I first started cooking for community, I started learning a lot about medicines, about like the life of like that food. The word food can mostly means something that you're going to consume that you might have bought at the store. The word in Ojibwe, mijim, has a different significance, and it has a significance that's about like an offering, and that you're not just feeding yourself physically. So I think there, you know, from that, I think through language, through Anishinaabe Mun, like Ojibwe language, is where some of that traditional knowledge comes from, or like from, you know, my understanding of food and its role.
I think that we can definitely understand that food is much more than just something we consume. Food is one of the most important and intimate ways that we are in relationship with land and our ecological community. Unfortunately, in Canada, our relationships with land are characterized by the horrific injustices of settler colonialism. It is essential to acknowledge that the devastating impacts of industrial resource extraction developments are experienced disproportionately by Indigenous peoples whom the government has systematically disadvantaged for centuries. Decolonization through Indigenous sovereignty, leadership, and self-governance is vital to the success of any efforts for the reconciliation of Canada's part in the dark history and ongoing legacy of European exploitation on Turtle Island. In order to decolonize the construction of strategies for the pursuit of environmental justice, it is crucial to consider perspectives that are based in Indigenous worldview. I had the chance to sit down with Carolyn Crawley during her time at FoodShare and hear her share her thoughts on environmental justice.
Yeah, when I think of those words, Indigenous environmental justice, hearing that language makes me feel that it's something separate from us. There isn't a piece of a relationship when I hear those words. So it's coming from a very different worldview in that sense. But when I think about Indigenous environmental justice, I'm thinking it's about returning back to relationship with land, right, that we once all had at one point in time in history. And how do we reconcile with that relationship with land? Because we can see today there's a lot of taking from the land, and there's no reciprocity, or there's a lack of reciprocity. And so I think when we're looking at environmental justice, the big focus for me is the relationship piece and the reconciliation piece, because the land has been damaged, unfortunately. And how do people today work in relationship with the land in a good way?
Repairing damaged relationships with land is essential to creating environmental justice on Turtle Island for both Indigenous peoples and settlers alike. Recovering and reclaiming traditional knowledge of how to cultivate Indigenous foods and medicines can be a profound source of healing in our relationships with land, other people in our communities, and within ourselves. During my time in the Masters of Environmental Studies program, I've been very inspired by the work of my classmate, Joseph Pitawanakwat. Joe's business, Creator's Garden, focuses on teaching about traditional medicines within Indigenous communities. I sat down with Joe and his colleague, Bidabin Pelche, to hear some of their stories about how their work has contributed to creating environmental justice. Joe spoke about his time at Grassy Narrows, a place where people are dealing with the terrible impacts of clear-cutting and mining industries.
They want to maintain access to all of their traditional territory, and so they stop the logging. And they have a little blockade. And also, when I went over there, Trudeau just got in government, and he gave them like $300,000 to figure out the blockade, because if they're able to figure it out, then he's gonna be able to say that he helped with the longest standing blockade, and it'll help with his next election or whatever. I don't know. But he gave them a bunch of money anyway, and they didn't know what to do with it. So they were hiring lawyers from Winnipeg, and they were just siphoning all of that money away. And so when I went there, we identified, we were able to understand that because of the mercury exposure, they had a really strong epidemic of kidney-related diseases. There's some people in the, when I was there, there's a little girl, she couldn't even count. She's standing on the deck and she's counting cars driving by, and she doesn't even know how to count. But she turned to me and she said, "Yeah, I have a urinary tract infection." This little girl says urinary tract infection, but she can't even count. And so I started asking what's going on, and then we were able to identify that they have a really scary epidemic of kidney-related diseases because of their mercury exposure. Their kidneys can't flush it out fast enough, so everything is slowed down. So what the plan was that we made as we went, I said, we'll go pick kidney medicine. We'll go find bearberry. We call it Bnekubis. And so I told them, I said, take me to a place that has big pine trees, but it has that caribou lichen, that caribou moss, that white, crunchy moss underneath of pine, and like sand. And so they knew exactly what I was talking about. They said, I know where that is, and we went straight there, and it was bearberry was everywhere. It was like a carpet. And we filled up a truck really fast with all that medicine, we hung it up, and they started to give that medicine away. And they started to experience how effective it was at solving kidney-related diseases, where they were having a whole bunch of stories of people who were using that medicine that we picked, and their kidney diseases were going away. And so the plan that we made was really fun. The plan that we made was to never mind giving the lawyers all of this money and to hire a case manager, use that money to hire a case manager to follow all of those stories of when somebody would use the land or interact with the land to be able to fix their kidney problem, and to document that and to record that. And so when you go back to court against these big logging companies that want to clear cut it all, you're able to give them this massive cabinet full of documents that show why you need to have untouched access to this land is because this is how much people that we were able to help with their kidney problems. And so we created this this idea and this project, and there's all kinds of other politics at play, so I don't know what actually ended up happening with it. I'm going to go back soon, but the that's the way that, that's a perfect story to sort of outline the way that I would see or that I would define Indigenous environmental justice, is when we're able to look at a problem like industry, and to be able to use the land and generate stories from the land, and be able to show that to the company, and to say, this is why we need it, and this is why you can't remove it, is because it's necessary for life. To be able to live here, we need this. To be able to have Bumatsuin, or to be alive, we need this Mshkikiatsuin, and we need to be engaging with that.
Mshkikiatsuin, or medicine knowledge, much like food knowledge, is crucial to creating health in our relationships with our environment. Bidabin shared a story about the youth in Pikangikum and their experience in learning about traditional medicines.
And you see it with the youth. They haven't been told, or they haven't been given the opportunity to find their place where they're grounded in it and needed and wanted. And my favorite story is what Joe had shared about being in Pikangikum and working with one particular youth in a collective of the youth, and just putting a medicine into their hand to say, the elders, this will help them if you go get this. You know, I have to leave, you know, after the week or 2 weeks he was there. So you have to carry on this work to be in relationship with the environment and this plant, and bring it, carry it to the elders, and help them along with that. And just from that little, it seems very little, but it's very potent aspect of relationship, that they begin to feel needed and wanted, you know, and that would be, I would say, one of the best things that we could do for the youth as well, is show them the ties of how they begin to maneuver and negotiate their position within community and within environment, within that institution or within that system of creation. And then there's no arguing with them. They would say, this is a very important job that I have. And this is a very important knowledge that I've gained from the plant in this maneuvering and this negotiating and relationship with community as well. Right? And then they become intrinsic to all those relationships. And then hopefulness for them, it's like there's no room for hopelessness. Because they're like, no, I have to continue to do this.
It can be seen that having a sense of place and community and an understanding of one's roles and responsibilities in the relationships that we share with our environment can provide a sense of having a purpose in the world. This place-based sense of purpose is a powerful tool for Indigenous peoples when confronting the mental health crisis that has arisen from the impacts of colonization. While the Truth and Reconciliation Commission has mainly focused on addressing the trauma resulting from residential schools, resource extraction industries continue to undermine Indigenous peoples' relationships with land. Ray Owl is a member of the Traditional Ecological Knowledge Elders Group, who have tirelessly been advocating against the aerial spraying of glyphosate herbicide as a part of the forestry industry practices being used around his home in the Robinson-Huron Treaty Territory. The ecological implication of this toxic monocrop timber forestry cultivation practice is the elimination of important plants that provide habitat for insects and wildlife, as well as diverse sources of food and medicine for Indigenous peoples. While the following recording of Ray may be challenging to hear, His testimony articulates the decimation that is occurring in the ecological system that supports his culture and livelihood in order to facilitate the monocrop timber forests that are desired by the extractive clear-cut industry.
Those bugs, every one of those bugs has, there's a purpose in life, in the creation of the world, that they're there for a reason. The Creator put them there for that reason, to make everything else grow in harmony. You're killing actually the earth slowly at a time by, you know, starting from the bottom up. You kill the tree, you kill the First Nations food source, because there's animals that are Anishinaabe depends on, like moose, deer, rabbit, porcupines, bears, they all depend on that foliage. And right now, it's kind of sad to go in the bush and we'll see nothing in the forest. Very little scares.
It is clear that this monocrop-minded forestry agenda is resulting in a reduction of biodiversity and a loss of the species that First Nations people have long depended upon for food and medicine. The rights of First Nations people cannot be ignored, and industrial practices that compromise Indigenous ways of life must come to an end before the traumatic alienation in relationships with land that is caused by colonization can begin to heal and reconciliation can truly be considered. For too long, treaties have been misinterpreted and misconstrued to dehumanize Indigenous people, undermine their sovereignty, and limit their access to the basic necessities for human life. I spoke with Andrea Bastian of Indigenous Climate Action about the importance of advocacy work for increasing access to Indigenous foods.
Being able to provide for yourself locally, you know, it has so many positive effects. You know, when people can provide for themselves, they feel good about themselves. Not only do they feel good about themselves, but they're able to nourish themselves, and then that in turn makes them more productive people. And perhaps that means, you know, there's less health issues, less, you know, involvement with having to deal with, you know, the health industry. And so when we look at the outcomes of being able to do this work in a good way, it outweighs the way that they're seeing it.
We can see that engagement in Indigenous food systems has cascading benefits that contribute to many aspects of creating holistic health in Indigenous communities. While Western approaches to both medicine and ecology have been failing Indigenous peoples, Indigenous ways of being in relationship with land can have profoundly beneficial impacts for both people and the land.
You know, it's really just a matter of relationship to this land, right? Our people have known this land from time immemorial. Who's going to know how to use it better? And, you know, when we look at conservation success rates of, you know, like Western folks stewarding the land, yeah, sure, they're successful, but not as successful as the same types of projects that are stewarded by Indigenous peoples. And it's not a one knows better than the other, it's about the relationship and how deep that goes. And so we can really look at exemplifying how this work looks by identifying Indigenous leaders within the work.
Grassroots activism from within the Indigenous community is essential to the endeavor of achieving Indigenous environmental justice. As individuals, whether we are Indigenous or not, we can all do our part to cultivate meaningful and reciprocal relationships with the land that sustains us. Connecting with the land where we are, as well as connecting with the time when we are both powerful practices that can deepen our understanding of the relationship we share with the food that we eat. When I spoke with Carolyn Crawley, she explained to me how eating with the seasons can be a way of adhering to the natural laws which govern Indigenous food systems.
Something as simple as eating within the seasons, right, is part of a natural law. Like what is being offered to us in that present moment during the season, and knowing that those particular foods are to nourish our bodies in that particular time, that are needed. You know, so we could think about in the winter months, to help prepare us to go into that winter when we think about the foods that are available in the autumn time. And those foods help to prepare us to store that energy so that we can make it through the winter. So when I think about that, it's really observing those natural laws when we think about the environmental justice piece. And that's something that I think non-Indigenous people need to kind of think about more.
Personal work of Indigenous activists, as well as non-Indigenous individuals as allies, is an important aspect of the pursuit for Indigenous environmental justice. However, contributions to this pursuit from government as well as industry as retribution, which holds them accountable for their part in creating the situation that disadvantages Indigenous people, is also necessary for addressing these systemic issues. The late elder Louis de Bossiguet shared a story with me about his family's farm that illustrates approaches to accountability and conflict resolution that are based in an Indigenous worldview.
Came from a very well-to-do farm. It says, matter of fact, it produced more than we could use up ourselves. So, and my grandfather, being a traditional or a hereditary chief, was also compelled to share that what was harvest from that farm. Slaughtered 25 pigs, and he would distribute that. The last crop we brought in was turnips, and everybody got 2 bags of turnips in their root cellar every fall, because that was what was believed to be provided by the hereditary chief. Feed the people first, or exchange. And they had their own, he had their own understanding of justice. I often tell the story of my uncle spotting young boys stealing produce at the end of the farm. So he goes and tells grandfather's kids over there stealing stuff. He says, you run after them. Barnes starts running. And of course, those boys ran away. Ran away with bags of produce and all this. So Lawrence comes back, and my grandfather asks him, says, do you know who they are? Oh yeah, I know who they are. Okay, says, you go and pick up more of the stuff they took and all this, and I'll hitch up the horse and buggy, load up, and we'll go and see them. So that's what they did. So they rode up to this two houses, and those boys came from both houses, and once my grandfather and Lawrence were spotted, says they took off out of the back door into the bush, because they knew they were caught. And my grandfather says, come in, says, hauled in his bags of produce, and the parents are guessed by that time what was happening. My grandfather said, here's more, in case the boys didn't get enough. There was no talk about stealing. So my grandfather said to the two sets of parents, he says, you could help us. He says, in the fall, we're always short-handed. We need some muscle. We need some good workers to harvest everything. You come up in the fall and you get your share. So that's what happened. And then after harvest, he says, my grandfather told him again, he said, you got very good working family here. Long hours they're willing to put in. They don't distract each other. He says, why don't we have land adjacent to each other? He says, good bush lots. Why don't we cut some wood, sell half of it, and then use and have for our own use over the winter, which they did. And then he says to them, after they cut wood, I've got two teams of oxen. We'll pull the stumps and prepare the land for sowing in the spring. They pull the stumps and till the ground, rip it up, and dress it up for sowing the next spring, which they did. And those two families always worked with us closely thereafter. Justice was not punitive. Justice was giving capacity so those young boys don't have to steal. Justice served us and honored those people, restored honor in those in that family and all this. That's traditional justice.
Lewis's story embodies the type of restorative justice principles that can be applied in the design of retributive action from government and industry that can create social cohesion amidst Canada's effort for reconciliation. Through supporting Indigenous peoples in their self-determination and governance over their respective territories, approaches to community development and environmental conservation can be decolonized. Empowerment of Indigenous peoples in the reclamation and continuation of traditional practices of being in relationship with land is essential to creating climate action strategies that do not uphold colonial legacies. I hope that this podcast can serve as an educational resource for understanding Indigenous environmental justice and that my work as an ally can become effective through your engagement and advocacy around these important issues which all of us are implicated in and affected by. Thanks for listening.